Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is the United States v. Glover. Mr. Carlson.
May it please the court. Counsel. My name is Kent Carlson, and I was court appointed to represent Roy Glover both in the district court and before this court. Most of what I intended to argue is contained in the briefs, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time covering the same material, but there are a couple of things that I really wanted to bring to the court's attention, and in some respects they kind of dovetail together a little bit. And the first is the mere presence instruction that was requested at the jury instruction conference and denied by the court. And I think what really makes that a very important issue in this case is that Judge Manning herself, when we argued whether the testimony of the drug expert, Officer Coleman, should be allowed, Judge Manning said, well, shouldn't we allow that? Because what if we disbelieve the testimony of the officers? And I think that's what's really important here, because if we disbelieve the testimony of the officers as Judge Manning posed in her hypothetical, then Mr. Glover could clearly have been merely present.
But Mr. Carlson, forgive me, but isn't a mere presence instruction designed to be used when a defendant says, I was just standing next to my friend while he was selling drugs, but I didn't have any involvement. Is it even possible to have a mere presence defense if a defendant is the only one present? This is new to me.
I agree that I think that that's generally what the instruction and the notes to the Seventh Circuit's pattern instruction say. But here we have a situation where Mr. Glover is not in any physical possession of any drugs. The drugs are on the ground. He is merely in the presence of drugs. And if we, as Judge Manning suggested, disbelieve the testimony of the officers, he's merely present. And again, the standard that has been set for jury instructions is whether there is some evidence, believable or not. And I think Judge Manning herself suggested that there was some evidence that the testimony of the officers could be disbelieved, and therefore I think giving that instruction was appropriate in those circumstances. And that was the basis for her saying we should allow the testimony of Officer Coleman. And I still believe, as I argued then, that the testimony of Officer Coleman was not, in this case, appropriate. And this court has affirmed the use of a drug expert's testimony in certain instances, but this was a case where it just wasn't appropriate.
I would assume that the average jury member has no idea whether 2.1 grams of heroin is a personal use amount or an amount that can be distributed to many people. In fact, the average American probably has no idea of what 2.1 grams of anything looks like. Why is it improper to have an expert testify that a particular quantity of drugs is likely to have been meant for distribution? How else would a jury get any idea of whether 2.1 grams of heroin was Glover's afternoon fix or enough for 40 people?
First of all, I don't believe that he offered an opinion on that specific issue, and I don't think he could. I think he said that it is consistent with personal use, and it's consistent with the distribution amount. And he said, he admitted himself, sometimes his opinion is right, sometimes it's wrong. That being the case, I'm not sure that that was really helpful to anyone.
Why wouldn't it be helpful to a jury in understanding what drug quantities mean in the real world? Why not?
And in my point is, if that's what he could testify to, I think that would be a different situation. I think you would run into a question then of him giving an opinion on a defendant's mental state, which is something that I don't think he is qualified to do, and I don't think the law permits him to do. But he, I don't think he is in a position to be able to say that.
This is the kind of testimony that this court has held, upheld, I suppose I should say, over and over and over and over again. I mean, there, what is unusual about this case?
In certain circumstances, I agree that that kind of testimony is appropriate. But we're not talking about the kind of quantities here that he could give an opinion on. If we were talking about kilogram quantities and he were to give an opinion, that would be one thing. If he was talking about large quantities of drugs, this amount was not that amount, and he could not, and he admitted that he couldn't give a definitive answer
well,
as
you,
to what
I mean,
it
you
was.
You say it wasn't, but he had what approximately would amount to 21 to 42 doses of heroin, if it, you know, if it's the type that's used intravenously. That's a lot of heroin.
And again, I'm not suggesting it isn't a lot, but it is not so much that it is a situation where he could even definitively say that it was a distribution amount or a personal use amount. And I think when the question we're having when we talk about that is putting aside to a second whether we even need to get to that testimony, because if the officer's testimony is believed, the officer says he sees the distribution happening, and therefore that testimony isn't even really necessary for the jury to hear. The jury, if they believe the officers, don't need to hear from an expert to say this was intended for distribution. If they disbelieve the officers, then they're saying he didn't possess the drugs in the first place. So it's not a question that's helpful to the jury, and I think that's the, really what the crux of this matter is and why this case is different from many of the other cases that this court has dealt in. Here you either believe the officers or you don't believe the officers. If you believe the officers, he's guilty of the possession with intent to distribute or distribution. If you don't believe the officers, he's not guilty of that altogether. And the officer's testimony adds absolutely nothing to that, except giving an extra stamp of affirmance to his belief of what generally occurs when we have testimony what directly occurred here. And I think that's really what we're talking about, is what directly occurred, what was observed, and what wasn't. I just don't see that that testimony is helpful to the jury. And then to, at the same time, then say you're not going to give the mere presence instruction, I think denies Mr. Glover a fair trial.
I ask you a question before you sit down or your light comes on. Generally, when you write these briefs, you lead with your strongest argument, and your first argument is about the fingerprint testimony. And I don't know if you want to pursue that or not, or just stand on the briefs on it, but I was wondering when I looked at the arguments whether you ever offered to stipulate that there were no fingerprints on the gun, or offered or were asked to stipulate to that by the prosecution. Because what happens in all these drop gun cases is the defense argues, hey, there's no fingerprints on the gun. So the prosecution wants to foreclose that kind of an argument. And so was that ever discussed? Or
quite honestly, it was discussed. And one of the problems is the government wanted to be able to call someone to testify as to the reasons why there might not be fingerprints on a weapon. And one of the problems...
Was this off the record, or is there something in the record to tell us that you offered to... not make any argument about the fingerprints, a lack of fingerprints?
There's nothing on the record to that. That was discussions between Mr. Ferguson, who was the assistant who handled the case, and myself. And quite honestly, I think it was understood that that was an argument that would be made. I don't know how we could not make that argument in light of the facts of this case, especially when we have a situation where the expert who is testifying doesn't have most of the information. All she can testify is to, generally, there aren't fingerprints. Well, there are legions of cases in which this court has upheld convictions based on the presence of a fingerprint on a gun. So we know that they can be left on guns. She didn't have any information to suggest why there may not be a fingerprint. The most common one might be that the officer who picked up the gun wiped the prints off, or just by his mere picking it up, smudged the prints to the point that it wasn't identified. She couldn't even testify to that. So that's, you know, it made it a situation where the government insisted on calling an expert, and I don't think that expert's testimony helped the jury very much.
You want to save some time?
Yes. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Donovan?
May it please the Court, Counsel. Your Honors, the judgment of the district court should be affirmed, and I'd like to address initially the fingerprint expert. That expert's qualifications were thoroughly vetted, both in voir dire and before the jury. And ultimately, Your Honor, the issue of the recovery of ridge impressions on the magazine of that weapon was an important fact that was before the jury. The inferences that counsel wanted to draw for the defense, as well as the inferences that the government wanted to draw from that limited amount of evidence, are certainly proper argument before the jury. However, when the average juror hears the statement, "The defendant's fingerprints were not found on the gun," which was a statement that was made in closing argument here, the average juror will immediately begin to question whether or not the defendant ever touched that gun. It is appropriate to assist the jury in evaluating the limited degree of evidence that was found and the type of surfaces on which the examiner had to try to find any ridge detail or, in fact, full fingerprints that could be compared to the defendant's fingerprints.
I don't have any problem with that. You have a perfect right to do that, and you ought to do it. But if the other side offers to not say a word about fingerprints, not to argue that there's an absence of fingerprints, then that's wanted to know if that was discussed at all prior to getting involved in all this testimony from an expert.
And I apologize, I can't represent to the court what the discussions were because I was not part of the trial team on this particular case. All I can indicate is my experience has been that usually stipulations are entered into that reflect that no latent fingerprints or latent prints suitable for comparison were found on the weapon. Whether or not Mr. Carlson offered not to mention that in closing or not to argue that the defendant's fingerprints were not on the gun, I can't address.
Okay.
But given the fact that there is going to be a question in the mind of the average juror, I think the fact that exists, whatever the results of the fingerprint examination were, is important to the government to present in order to give the jury the full picture of what the evidence is. And I think particularly in order to be able to allay any jurors' concerns based on their lack of knowledge of fingerprint examination, that in fact the lack of a fingerprint does indicate that perhaps the defendant didn't touch this gun and thereby impugn the credibility of the officers, which is, of course, the case that was presented by the defense in this particular instance. With respect to Mr. Coleman's testimony on the distribution amounts of and packaging of drugs.
Can we just stay, please, if you wouldn't mind, with McCulloch's testimony? Because in the government's brief, you maintain that for the first time on appeal, defendant objects to McCulloch's testimony on the ground that the district court failed to assess her reliability under Daubert. And I am trying to understand that in light of Mr. Carlson's argument at the top of page 3 of his reply brief, which begins, the other thing is that she had absolutely no role in the investigation of this case. She didn't get these things until after this, after the gun and ammunition was tendered to her. She doesn't know the conditions under which it was recovered. She can't testify to any personal characteristics about Mr. Glover. She can't testify about what the weather conditions were. She can't testify about any of those things, Judge. And I'm wondering why that wasn't sufficient to have raised the issue in the district court in the government's mind.
Your Honor, it's the government's position that if the defendant wished to challenge the credibility or the, I'm sorry, the qualifications of Ms. McCallick or Officer McCallick, then a specific challenge should have been raised to that or to the application of what facts the...
How much more specific does a defendant have to get than what I just read to you?
Well, Your Honor, it's the government's position that, in fact, the context of the defendant's argument there is about the relevance. In other words, there are certain things that the expert wasn't aware of, and I think as the defendant goes on to argue, the defendant's really arguing that that testimony by the witness does not assist the jury, which I think is a relevance determination as opposed to the reliability. The defendant, in the government's view, did not attempt to impugn the testimony that the witness was actually going to give, which is that the witness found certain results on the items that were evaluated.
You go on to say defendant never objected to McCallick's qualifications or reliability of her testimony in the district court. I have to tell you, I really don't understand your argument on this issue.
I would just be the government's position, Your Honor, that as a fingerprint examiner, the defendant or the witness was qualified, and that the link between whatever questions about the witness's knowledge of the facts were was never drawn within the context of a Daubert objection or the application of whatever facts the witness knew to the case. Okay. With respect to Coleman's testimony, in fact, with respect to the distribution amount, and certainly the government is not required only to offer the evidence of the officers who observed a distribution, but is also entitled to offer expert testimony on the issue of whether or not packaging of the specific individual packets that were present here is in fact consistent with the practices of drug dealers. And as the government noted in its brief, Coleman never came even close to any testimony with respect to the intent of the defendant nor the specific facts of this case, and therefore the district court properly admitted Lieutenant Coleman's testimony. The other issue the government would like to address just briefly is with respect to the objection to comments in closing argument, and with respect to that, the government is entitled to comment on evidence that is offered by the defendant, entitled to comment on whether or not the defendant presented the most reliable source of information, entitled to comment that the defendant failed to produce documents to support a particular claim. In this case, the defendant offered the evidence of an individual claiming that the defendant worked for Comcast. Both of the comments that were made by the prosecutor in closing argument referenced whether or not either someone was called from Comcast or whether or not there were any records from Comcast. And that's an appropriate attack upon the witness who was called and does not in any way call into question whether or not the defendant himself should have taken the stand to.
The cross of the witness who testified, I believe it's a girlfriend?
There was a girlfriend, and then there were two of them, Your Honor. There's also a person from the neighborhood.
Did their cross produce some evidence of either inconsistency or error about their statement about employment at Comcast?
I don't believe they were internally inconsistent, Your Honor. It was just a question of whether or not there was a credibility issue with respect to them because both of them knew the defendant, and therefore whether or not more independent and reliable information as to the defendant's employment.
The government didn't offer evidence of someone at Comcast suggesting that he was not an employee, right?
No, Your Honor. But in sum, Your Honor,
if Mr. Carlson had suggested you failed in your proof in that regard in his closing argument, that would be acceptable, that the government was unable to disprove that he worked at Comcast?
Sure. I think that's an appropriate comment. Ultimately, those comments fell far short of what is necessary to establish error by the prosecutor. And for that reason, the government thinks that even the issue of whether or not there was a fair trial and the rest of the analysis isn't applicable. However, briefly, I would just address that these comments were not about the elements of the crime. They were simply about a rather collateral issue, and therefore the nature and seriousness here is not grave. Whether or not the defendant invited the comments, I think, in fact, by trying to bolster the witness, indicating that the witness was testifying pursuant to subpoena, did, in fact, invite the comment by the government in closing argument. Both prosecutors, the defendant, and the court instructed the jury properly, both before, immediately after, and in subsequent instructions. And therefore, I think that the instructions would be adequate to counter, if the court did find that there were anything improper with these comments, the instructions would be adequate to counter any impropriety. And finally, the defendant was able to rebut these claims immediately after they were made in defendant's own closing argument. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Donovan. Ms. Carlson?
Unless the court has any questions, I have nothing.
Apparently not. Thank you, Mr. Carlson, and thanks to both counsel. Mr. Carlson, you have an additional thanks to the court for accepting this appointment and ably representing Mr. Glover.